All right, this is the Meteor Podcast. We're going to be talking about smoked puss, pickled sucker, donkey dick, stuff like that, an array of which I have laid out in front of me. But first, I want to talk about a couple other things real quick. We're recording right now at Anchorage, Alaska. We're in Anchorage because I'm passing through Anchorage on the way out to hunt for a muskox out on Nunivak Island out in the Bering Sea. It's funny because on the way here, I was reading this book. The writer, Peter Matheson, who many people don't know who Peter Matheson is. People who do know who Peter Matheson is often know him through his book Snow Leopard. But Matheson in the 60s wrote this book about the muskox on Nunivak Island. And on his way to Nunivak Island in 1964, he passed through Anchorage, where I'm sitting right now. And he had this passage I was reading on the airport. I want to read this to, because I'm sitting here with a couple of guys from Anchorage, and I want to read him this passage. From Anchorage, there is no road westward, and it remains a frontier town. Despite its efforts at mainstream respectability, it still has pawn shops full of guns, hides, and snowshoes, and saloons jammed with Indians and prospectors. No longer gold, but oil. Violent death is not an unusual event in Anchorage, and its jail is full of wild young men. The town has a striking location by the sea on a plateau surrounded by mountains, and despite its recent earthquakes, its prospects are immense. But domesticity is soon to come. Its novelty stores will no longer sell small moose droppings made up as earrings, and it will be just another provincial town to which zoning came too late. He couldn't have been more wrong.
No, it hasn't changed.
I was like, you think this guy would have passed through Anchorage last night? Don't you feel that?
Oh, especially the moose drop earring thing. Yeah, you can still buy those all over town. Was that written in the 60s?
64.
Yeah.
Here's who's sitting here right now. My brother Dan Ronella and Brant Meixel. Both those guys, you might, if you happen to watch a show called Meteor, you might have seen these guys on the show. They're both biologists. Danny works with fish and aquatic ecosystems. Brant works with ducks. So they're as involved in wild games. They're involved in wild game. It's the life of wild game and not just like what happens after it's dead, but things of the nature of keeping wild game around. And Mike Washleski. You Polish, Mike? Out of Austin, Texas. And then Janis Patelis. Janis, say something in Latvian. Say pickled pike in Latvian. Can't do it. He's not fluent.
Mm-mm. You know, my dad listened to the Bozeman episode, and he was happy that they don't air the Meteor Podcast in Latvia because he was a little embarrassed about my Latvian skills when he put me on the spot in the last one.
Yeah, Janis speaks Latvian, wears a special Latvian ring, went to Latvian camp, has never been to Latvia.
So we did get a trail cam pic of some nice looking.
That was amazing, man. Latvia, where Janis' family hails from, has actual wild boars. And I'm telling you, in the U.S., people are always talking about, like, Siberians, you know, like wild boars. It's like there's something else going on in Europe. You look at those pigs in Latvia, it's like that's a pure form of boar. Like, there's a lot of domestic strains that have weaseled their way into U.S. stock because them pigs are not the same deal.
They look very fleet-footed. Like that picture, God, it's like man. It must be some sort of a trail cam or a traffic cam pic. These pigs are running across the street at night in Riga, Latvia, in the capital city. And it almost looks like not a single pig's foot is actually on the ground. They're like running, and it's just, they're so quick. It's like, nobody's really touching the ground.
There's just like, hey, man, they look like a wild animal. In the guidebook, there's a picture of a wild pig. And I'm like, man, that pig is a wild pig running through the snow, and it wound up being a Eurasian pig. It's like the U.S. ones are a little bit different. We're getting way off subject. Smoked puss, donkey dick. We're going to talk about everyone here is involved in at a hobby level and beyond a hobby level, preserving wild game. So I'm talking about canning, drying, freezing, charcuterie, like whatever it takes to carry wild game over. And so I want to have a discussion with a bunch of people who I regard as having levels of expertise about what they like to do with wild game to hold it over. So this is everything excluding fresh consumption. And when I was thinking about this, I thought about dividing. I kind of like made some notes to myself. And they put all the different forms in alphabetical order. And within that, we're going to start talking about canning. And just what we have here. What do we have? Someone rattle off. Everybody rattle off what they have here that's canned.
Smoked octopus.
Dan's got smoked. Okay, smoked octopus. Where is it from? What's up with that?
It's an octopus that I caught at our the cabin that Steve and I and some others share in Saltry Cove, southeast Alaska. But it's an octopus that rode up from about 250 feet of water in a shrimp trap.
In it or on it?
In it.
Oh, he got in it.
In it. Yeah, and it was an octopus that I don't know, maybe, you know, the tips of its arms, if you kind of spread it out, it might be maybe 4 feet across. I mean, it's a substantial animal, but it fit through, you know, the eye in a shrimp pot, which is about, it's not as big around as a beer can, you know, yeah. So that somehow those things just contort their way through those little holes.
A little bit at a time.
Yeah, they get through there, you know, but yeah, so pulled it up and... And I was with Ron Lighton when we got it, and he took forearms, and I took forearms, and vacuum packed it, brought it back to Anchorage, and boiled it for a half an hour, smoked it for a few hours, then put it in a jar and processed it in a pressure cooker.
If it wasn't for smoked octopus, I wouldn't have gotten involved in buying that place, because like when you took me out to meet Ron, and he gave me that jar of smoked octopus, the best thing, man, just like so rich and perfect. And then Brant's got everything in the world canned here.
Yeah, so, all right on top, we got some canned rendered bear lard.
Which looks like lard.
Oh, looks like Crisco.
Yeah, it's way cooler, though.
Half pint jar of Crisco.
Then we got a can of canned bear meat, which getting the fat off all the little chunks of stew meat's practically impossible, so there's also some rendered fat in there.
Rise up.
Some canned smoked salmon. Some goat stock. From Mountain Goat from this fall. And then some donkey dick, a.k.a. summer sausage.
But we're not onto that yet. That's different. That's not the can.
So I'm jumping ahead, so we'll stop on that.
What is that?
And that last can is moose rib meat off the bone in a jar with barbecue sauce and then processed in a pressure cooker.
So a whole bunch of stuff, but that's the most interesting thing because so many people ditch rib meat or just grind it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with grinding. As long as you're using it for something, great. But like any possible other use you can find for that stuff. So you just like took the rib chunks.
Yeah.
And you say it's hit and miss.
It's hit and miss. And there's a lot of jar-to-jar variability.
But like from what? Fat?
Yeah, I think it's fat and just the overall amount of meat in there compared to connective tissue and stuff. It's like some of them are pretty good and some of them are pretty marginal, you know, and it's the whole range. I'd be curious to see what you guys think. We should try it.
You know, I want to check it out. Now, here, all the stuff we're looking at, the canned stuff we're looking at, is canned in glass. Just like classic Bell jars. It's ball.
Kerr and ball. Yeah.
Kerr and ball. But you should explain this to me because, for a while, you, Danny, got into canning game meat in steel cans.
Yeah.
The thing I always remember, man, it's so funny, is 1 year ago, back when we were just like so poor, you had sent down a teal.
Yeah.
You'd stuffed a teal inside a steel jar and canned it. And me and Matt carried that teal everywhere for the longest time, and we were eventually up hunting in Unit 652 on the Muscle Shell River for mule deer. I remember it. We had in our backpack the teal, the canned teal, and a whole bunch of slim, fast steel cans because Matt had this neighbor in Miles City named Wes who had died. And when he died, somehow or another, someone brought over all these cases of Slim Fast that were somewhere in, I don't know how I was affiliated with Wes's death, but we came into possession of a bunch of Slim Fast. I bring Wes up for an interesting thing because you want to talk about meat. Wes was, before he died and after he died, didn't have one of his thumbs. His thumb was gone. When he was a kid, they used to hook a, they'd take the tire off a truck and run a belt on the rim, and they would off that belt power a big buzzsaw to cut wood. And Wes cut his thumb right off. I mean, like the joint and everything. Cut his thumb off. And Wes said his brother took the thumb and threw it into the pig pen, and pigs just ate the thumb. Never got it reattached. So he had his Slim Fast and that Matt inherited, all the Slim Fast. And I remember we were walking around.
Because he couldn't open them.
We were walking around drinking Slim Fast with this can of teal in a can. I remember Pooter was there, and a friend of ours, Pooter, and he had drank about 6 Slim Fasts one day and was commenting that if this stuff really works, he's going to be skin and bones in no time. Maybe we opened up Dan's can of his can teal. And we must have been carrying it around too much because it was honestly like a can of bones.
It all just fell off the bone.
It all dissolved or something off the bone. So it's like, we're trying to make sandwiches out of it. You just had to like drink what's on top and then pick the bones out, you know? And it was like Danny's canned bones, man.
Well, home canning meat you're cooking it hot and you're cooking it long. It's when it's a pressure cooker, so water gets up to, what is it, about 220 in there? Yeah, it's under pressure, so it's way hotter than just like a pot of boiling water, and then you wind up processing the stuff, you know, for sometimes an hour or more, and so, yeah, you're really cooking the hell out of it, so it's
hard to gauge.
Well, I mean, it's hard to avoid. I mean, it's just part
That's what I'm saying. You just don't know, you know?
Yeah.
Like when I go to do, one of the things I like to cook is just to do corned meat in a pressure cooker, and you can't look, do you know what I mean? You're just like, I don't know. Sometimes you blast it. Sometimes you open it up and it's not ready. Sometimes you open it up and it's like broth. You know, you don't know. But what was with the steel canner? Like, you don't use it anymore.
You know, I still have it. I just haven't used it in a while. And I keep thinking I'm going to, but it's essentially the same process.
Was it supposed to be cheaper or what?
No, it's actually more expensive.
It is?
Yeah. Because, you know, when you're working with glass jars, they're reusable. All you need to do is buy it in the rings that seal down the lids are reusable, and the only thing you're buying are the lids.
You know,
and they're less than a buck a piece. But when you're canning in steel jars, you need, you know, you're replacing the whole jar, the whole can every time, you know, and they're kind of expensive actually just to buy them locally.
So what's the selling point? Just that you don't
need to break them? They're portable, they're light, they're unbreakable. Yeah. So it's nice for, you know, going on trips and things, not lugging glass around.
Oh, for sure, man.
Yeah.
You know, when we were kids, like, we had our laundry room doubled as a canning room. Like, it was kind of that era when people were really into canning, I think.
Yeah, a little back to the earth.
And my mom had all these shelves in the basement, and she would can venison, just cube up venison, do it. So, like, cube up venison, pack it into the jar raw, pour water on it, sometimes water and mustard, sometimes, like, a thin barbecue sauce. And then vaporize it in that can. But it was good, man. Like sandwiches and stuff like that.
I remember loving eating that stuff. And I started doing that again very recently.
Yeah.
And when I did it just like Mom used to do it. Just chunks of, well, it wasn't venison. Well, it was moose, not deer, but just chunks of moose meat in a jar and just straight into the pressure cooker, like just like Mom did it. And that turned out pretty good. But the other thing I did that I think improved it substantially was just browning it first.
Oh, is that right?
And then packing it in a jar.
But no sauce or anything?
Nope.
A little bit of salt.
Salt, yeah, a pinch of salt. That's all I put in there. Yeah,
just water and salt.
Yep.
And very little water.
You don't even, yeah. Right? Do you put water in?
You don't have to, but I do. I do. Not all the way up. Maybe half, three quarters of the way up.
That's what's funny about the smoked puss. It's sealed, but it just the pieces of puss bounce around in there like marbles, man.
Oh, that did you put water in there?
No. Yeah. I don't generally put water in.
So that's all just salmon fat in that jar right there.
That's salmon oil in there.
But that jarred chunked meat, especially the stuff that I browned first. Like if you're in a hurry and you didn't thaw out, you know, meat for dinner, and you just take some of that, and you can just shred it, you know, with a fork in a pan, and brown it and make tacos out of it, or
yeah,
or just throw it on a sandwich or whatever. It's like super fast and it's really good.
Throw a little barbecue sauce yep. in there.
Oh yeah, barbecue. It's basically just like having a leftover pot roast that you can shred instead. It just comes off out of a jar on the shelf.
That's the last time I canned a bunch of meat. It was for that reason, and that's what I use it for, is when you screw up and you don't thaw something
yeah,
out.
Exactly.
Like, no. You don't know, like, you whatever, you go away, you're doing something to your kids or something, and you come home, and you're like, man, I didn't thaw anything out, and it's so late, and everything's screwed up, and you're like, I'm going to have to, like, go order a pizza now or something.
Yep.
I would take that can and open up and do it.
Oh, make some tacos. Yeah.
Because it's like, you just, that way you can stay on a good, you know, game kick without blowing it off. But the last thing I canned not long ago, is I just made, we did this thing called a mixed boil where we boiled like tongue, all kinds of stuff in a pot, and the liquid was so good. I just canned all that. It was salted already, very salty. So you can't reduce it down to make like a demi-glace or something because it'd be like overpoweringly salty. But I jarred that, and now that stuff's soup in a can. Like you pour that stuff out, you just add anything to it and it's good.
Yeah.
You can put a carrot in there and it tastes good, man, you know? I did 12 quarts of that stuff over Thanksgiving, and I'm down to 2 quarts now. Yeah. So I've eaten 10 quarts in the last couple months, you know.
That's something that both Brant and I have been doing over the last several years now is just bringing a whole bunch of bones and making a bunch of stock out of them.
And so what do you guys do when you're doing that? What'd you do to make the goat stock?
So roast, cut up, quarter, bunch of onions, peppers, carrots, celery. Leave the skin on the onions. That's one of the things I've learned. The skins help give it that nice dark color. So quarter all the veggies. A lot of recipes you'll find will say, you know, kind of do the veggies and the bones together. But I go a little bit bigger. So I'll go just an entire baking sheet of veggies. Roast them till they're good and brown. Maybe put a little oil on them. Then do ribs. Ribs or femurs. Radius, ulna, whatever bones you have handy, roast those good till they're good and brown. Throw them all in the pot, cover them with water, and then simmer them real low for as long as you can stand it.
Like days?
I usually can get it done in a day, and then I'll let it cool down overnight because then all that that fat will solidify on the surface.
Yeah,
and it's real easy to pull off.
Yeah, if you set it outside, it comes off like a frisbee.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Do you strain yours?
I do, several times.
Cheesecloth? So
I use paper towels and a colander.
Yeah.
Yeah, I run through wire, then I run over cheesecloth. No, for no reason other than it just looks
nice. It's aesthetic, yeah.
Yeah.
Stock's got to look good, man. It's got to be clear. Like, I don't want it to be cloudy.
Yep. Yep.
It doesn't alter the flavor or the utility of it. Usually you're going through all the trouble
doing it. Yeah. It's like, it's just so easy to run. Even like a nylon or something, man. You run it through there to pull it out, you know? And then definitely get that fat off. But that fat, like earlier we were talking about Pooter and the Slim Fast. I was sick that he, this is such a hard story to tell, but you know what I'm going to talk about.
Oh.
So one night we're out drinking and we're talking about ice fishing at night. We're talking about late night ice fishing. Okay. Or like ice fishing all night. Later that night, Pooter starts telling a story about the way he likes to cook sausages, where he will add a bunch of butter to them and then cook them, and then they'll eat sausages and they'll leave them in the boiling liquid and put it in the fridge. So, you know, the fat sets up like a white thing. So hours go by after our ice fishing conversation, and this comes up, and Pooter says, I'll remember this sentence for the rest of my life. Of his sausages, he says, now you want to talk about some late night ice fishing. Auger a hole through that and see if you can't pull out one of them lunkers. Speak of trying to break through the layer of fat to pull out one of his sausages. All right. Done with Pooter. So, canning. That's like a basic rundown on canning. Now, I have like charcuterie written down, but then I got it broken down. So, I want to talk about drying because one of the things we have, you guys should check this out. Is I have moose, where is it? That's Brassola right there. Try this. I just washed all the mold off for you guys.
What is it?
That's off a shoulder. So
shoulder of what?
That's moose, chunk of moose shoulder. Okay. Brant's moose.
Oh, Matt Carlson.
This stuff is good.
Matt Carlson's really dialed in on this stuff too.
Now, all this is, so you make a kheer. Like, you take a piece of meat that's about as big around as a piece of French bread or a loaf of French bread, half as much as long, and pack it in a kheer. It sits in the kheer for a while, and then I put it into this thing called the umai dry bag, which is like, normally to make air-dried meat, you got to put it in cheesecloth and have the perfect temperature and shit to hang it up in your, you know, whatever, like a pastry room or something. But the bag, the umai bag, some people hate it. I love it. Because you put it in your fridge and put it on a rack and just cure it in air. So you can do, like, all kinds of things. You can do prosciutto, anything in the bag. It just takes longer, but you don't need to tend to it.
Yeah.
Now, Hank Shaw, he says he don't like those bags at all. But he's got higher standards than I have.
This is delicious. Like,
I'm telling you, man, I put that in the salt sugar kheer. Then I put it in that bag, and I put it in there around Thanksgiving. It's been in there months. And every week, I poke it. And when it gets to be like if you make a fist, a tight fist, and poke the space between your thumb knuckle and your pointer finger knuckle, and when it gets to feel like firm, like when you're making a tight fist and you push that patch of shit or whatever that is right there, your hide.
Muscle.
I'm telling you, man. And then I run it through a slicer. I have a deli slicer.
Okay.
Now, Carlson makes it the same way without doing the umai bags.
His is harder.
He lets it go longer. I could make that like a brick.
Yeah.
It's just like,
so is this bag thing, just like semi-permeable?
Semi-permeable.
It slows it. Okay.
Yeah, semi-permeable. So now, I know a guy. I don't want to know who it is. I can tell you who it is. But I know a guy who sent some of that material off to a lab to find out what exactly is it and is it patent protected. And they couldn't figure out what the hell it was.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't know what it is. It works, man. But here's the thing. It's soft because that's the middle. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's harder.
If I waited for the middle to be perfect. So anyways, this stuff you never cook it, the bresaola. It's like bresaola. You never cook it. So you cure it, and then you let it dry. Then you slice it, and it's like jerky that's never been smoked, never been cooked, never been nothing. It's the best thing on the planet, man. It gets a white mold on it. Hank Shaw said, don't worry about the white mold. I hit a Twitter message to the umai people. They said, don't worry about the white mold.
Yeah, how thick is that mold on the outside?
Not like a mill.
Just a little layer.
A layer. Okay. Very easy to wash off. But that stuff, man, my kids like that junk.
Yeah, my kids would like that too.
I love it. That's just like a dried meat. You know?
I've only tried it once. I just hung a chunk like on a hook on a, you know, 18-inch piece of string in the garage at 50-some degrees for months. Waited for that same tenderness too, and it was good. It had this flavor, but it also had this little bit of
a little fermented.
Yeah, a little bit of twang that was tough.
This has a tiny bit of twang.
Well, don't you hang duck breasts up in your shed?
Back when I used to duck hunt, yeah.
Did it never turn out?
Oh, they were okay. They were dry. Yeah, they were edible. Yeah. I mean, they weren't as good as that. No,
that stuff is good.
I think that white mold on meat is kind of appetizing too. That might sound a little weird, but well, like on a salami.
Yeah. Salami's just on there.
Yeah,
man.
I think it's beautiful.
A buddy of mine who's a chef, man, he says black fuzzy mold is the only mold he cares about.
Oh, the only mold he avoids.
He don't like black fuzzy mold. He don't give a shit about green mold, white mold. Black fuzzy mold is trouble.
Yeah. You ever made sauerkraut?
Yeah.
Oh, not mold. You skim off that stuff.
Oh, yeah. That stuff gets rank. The best jerky I ever had was definitely in Hawaii, hunting with the guys on Molokai who just do air-dried jerky, where they teriyaki the jerky, and then they got boxes because of all the bugs, screened in boxes. They just set the box out in the sun for days and days and days, and the screen keeps the bugs out, and their jerky is the best thing, man. Never heat, never touches it, you know. This recipe right here is out of Ruhlman's book Charcuterie, which in my mind is the Bible on all things cured and dried meat. I mean, it's just like his stuff. It's like there's not a ton of stuff in there. It's slim. The book is slim. He doesn't give thousands of variations of everything. But it's like, I've never had anything out of Ruhlman's book not work. And I've done it all with Wild Game. And I was fortunate to sit down and talk to him for a long time with it and, like, you know, about doing Wild Game. And he messes around with Wild Game a lot. And just, like, he doesn't see any reason why the preparations aren't the same. It's weird, like, when you look at cookbooks, like, you remember that, like, probably the number one selling Wild Game book of all times, that L.L. Bean cookbook?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, here's an antelope recipe. Here's a moose recipe. So we always get messages from people being like, do you have any moose recipes? I'm like, I don't, like, that doesn't mean anything to me. It's like, the recipe should follow the where you cut the chunk of, what chunk of the animal it is. Like, there's shank, there should be shank recipes, backstrap recipes,
meat recipes.
Ground meat recipes, meat recipes.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no such thing as a moose recipe.
No.
You know? But that's the other thing that I find. The point I was going to raise about that is I don't spend a lot of time I don't spend a lot of time even looking at Wild Game cookbooks. I just look at cookbooks of people who do stuff I like, and then just over time, you kind of get a sense of what you can pull off or not with game, you know?
So we'll say, though, about that L.L. Bean cookbook, like, he does have it broken out by all the different species.
His ossobuco is antelope ossobuco.
That's right, yeah.
Well, but what about the raccoon recipes and the muskrat recipes and the beaver recipes? Like,
mm-hmm.
Would you do moose
you're
like
right
that?
There. No, no.
That's
why,
trying to cover up
that's
some
not
stuff.
What I say. I say hooved game. Hooved game. Now, yeah. Don't. In the guidebook, which is not a cookbook, but in the cooking section of the forthcoming guidebook that we've been working on for years now, we treat it as hooved game.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah.
Hooved game. And then you got clawed game, which is a narrow. Yeah. Bear. Like, bear, I do stuff with bear that I would not do with anything else. You know, I don't eat bear steaks. You know? What do you guys, what's your main jerky? Like, you guys do jerky?
Yeah.
Remember Dar growing up? Like, not growing up. Late. Dar, like, dad's fishing buddy. Dar, he was scoffing at the idea of making jerky. That's probably like the last time we ever hunted with him.
Oh, when we were on the slope.
No. We were hunting rabbits. And I remember because, like, my old girlfriend finally took a rabbit. Like, what percentage of rabbits are squeal when you shoot them?
Like, one.
Yeah, okay. I finally get my girlfriend to go rabbit hunting. First rabbit we shoot. I'm like, you gotta make this never happens. Oh my god. On that trip, which is a long time ago, Dar said, I just eat everybody else's jerky.
He doesn't want to waste
his own deer meat when everybody else brings it into work for him. You guys do jerky? Like, what do you do?
You know, I'm the only real insight I have on jerky is I really like it cut with the grain.
I disagree completely with that.
I think it tastes kind of mushy if you cut it across.
I don't like cross grain jerky.
Yeah, I like it with the grain.
You like cut cross grain?
I like to cut it.
It just tastes all dried out.
No, it's actually got moisture in it. I like to cut it thicker though. Like, I like it to be more like that. Like, it's not technically called jerky. If you were to buy it in the gas station, it's like a steak cut that's jerkied.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. I like to make it more like that, where it's more like you're biting into a dry piece of steak as opposed to a dry piece of cardboard that doesn't taste good.
I wouldn't even be able to tell if it's done your way, because when I'm making jerky, my test is when I bend it, does it not snap and does it reveal white fibrous lines?
Oh, that's just so overdone, man.
Oh, really?
Like, I like to do
you
my.
You know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. That's what I like. I see that, and I'm not interested.
You don't give it a dog.
I like to have my jerky done as much as if you're doing, like, say, smoked salmon. You know, like, more like the doneness as if you threw a steak on the grill and cooked it.
Yeah,
but dry and cured.
You know? I got you. Yeah, I'm ashamed to say this. Like, I wish it wasn't true, but in my mind, not that I have any problem with this company. I can't even think of the name of the company. But in my mind, the best jerky that I make is when I buy when you see those kits with the cure and the seasoning. Like, I have done many, many, and I have experimented with them back and forth. But, like, just for reliable crowd pleaser jerky that your 4-year old is gonna like. Those little kits.
The kits, yeah, they are. Yeah.
It's just good, man. Yeah. You know?
Key ingredient, man. MSG.
Yeah.
And it's so
makes
easy.
Everything good.
Listen, I say this with shame. Like, I'm like a guy, like I'm like a guy who's admitting to, you know, I mean, I say it with shame. I'm not proud of it, but I'm just saying it's like if someone said make jerky to please the masses, I would do that kind of jerky. Because there's something in there that changes the meat, you know what I mean? Like, you can't go and make gas station jerky.
I can try.
What? Like, but a friend of mine pointed out, you can't make a Dorito. Do you know what I mean? People say, like, what's the weirdest thing you ever ate? I'm always like, Cool Ranch Doritos. You go try to make me a Cool Ranch Dorito in your house. I don't care how much shopping you do, you will never make a Cool Ranch Dorito. That is science. And gas station jerky is not actually, it might be people meat. I don't know what it is, man.
No, I hear what you're saying. There's a difference between, I mean, what we kind of try to do. All of our, what we're talking about is processed meat, but we're still trying to somewhat stay away from the overly processed.
Exactly.
And I'd say as a general goal of eating game pretty much every day, what I try to stay away from is the overly processed food while I still process. We're talking about cooking or canning our meat at 225 degrees for an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, it's processed, but trying to, quote unquote, keep it pure. And so, yeah, trying to do something that's as processed as a Dorito, you're not going to do it, but do you want to do that?
No, I'm with you. Now, do you or do you not do pink salt on recipes?
I rock kosher salt, man.
So you don't do pink salt number one, pink salt number two on like cured hams and stuff like that?
No, I don't. I don't go with nitrates either in like my summer sausage.
No, that's nitrate. Yeah. One's a nitrite, one's a nitrate.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's one or two. There's no empirical evidence to suggest that you shouldn't. I do, but I always feel like worried about it, but then you can't find any real reason to be worried about it.
Yeah, I haven't looked into the science on it, but you always hear it's bad for kids.
They used to give it to inmates to keep their libido down. Saltpeter.
Oh, that's
straight saltpeter. Petered out. They would give them saltpeter to keep them from sodomizing each other.
I've heard that one.
You have heard that? Or
no, I have not.
No. I don't know if it worked or not. You heard that, Mike? Mike's knowingly shaking his head. Mike's, is that what you had in jail?
We're going to take a quick break to service our sponsors. We'll be right back.
Pink salt one. So if you don't know what we're talking about, when you're looking at recipes for any kind of cured meat that's striving toward some sort of like shelf-stable attributes like hams and stuff, you'll often see where people want prog powder, which is pink salt one, or pink salt one. Or what are the names you ever see it as? It's about it. Prog powder and pink salt. One is a nitrate. One is a nitrite. And the difference between the two, I could look it up right now. Someone can look it up. One is that one tends to last longer.
Yeah, I don't know the difference.
Anyways, most stuff has pink salt one in it. I use it. A lot of people have an idea that you shouldn't be dicking around with it. And some people say that the only thing you get out of it anyways is it makes stuff vibrant red. So when you eat like an old red, like, you know, they used to call hot dogs like reds or red hot or something like that because they had a super vibrant red to them. That comes from that pink salt. And when you do corned meat, you put the pink salt in there and it really makes – because if you make like corned meat for St. Paddy's Day – it'll always get this sort of grayishness as you get in. The cure doesn't penetrate, you know, and it gets gray in the middle. You do like, you put pink salt in there and that sumbitch is pink, you know, all pink inside.
Morton's Tender Quick. I mean, that's what I use, but
it's loaded with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like basically salt with nitrates added to it, I think.
Yeah. It's sugar and salt and sugar, ton of sugar and nitrates.
You're saying the only thing it does technically is the color, but the whole purpose of it is that it's a preservative.
It does, right? Color, but it also has it functions as a preservative. So,
and that's where the potential health concerns come in, because you're basically pickling your stomach.
Yeah, or I don't even know. I've never read like a compelling thing about it. But it's just like some stuff is so, when it comes to this issue, like not eating things or eating things, I tend to think we're not done making colossal mistakes, right? Like we laugh, like, can you believe people used to, you know, whatever? Like people used to be out playing and they'd be spraying DDT on them. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. That joke isn't done being funny. Our kids will say, can you believe about something we're doing right now? And yeah, it's not going to be drinking water. It's going to be like something like that. Oh, yeah, tree to drink. Yeah, it could be the tree to drinking water. Let me make it there. It's not going to be that they're baffled that we used to just eat deer meat. They'll be baffled that we used to put pink salt on that shit. I'll move down the line. Freezing. I got a million things to say about this. I believe for red meat, hooved game meat, the best thing to do is to wrap it very tightly in plastic wrap, saran wrap. I don't care. I'm not saying saran wrap. You know what I mean? Like saran style plastic wrap, cling wrap. Wrap it very tight. And cling wrap, the good stuff, not the cheap stuff. Buy it on, buy the big ass rolls on Amazon because they never end. Like the 1800 foot rolls. It seems like you're taking it in the shorts, but then you realize that 3 years later you still have the same roll of saran wrap. And then I do a layer of waxed freezer paper, wax side in, very tight. And I'm telling you, you can eat meat. Done that way, if you trim all the fat off it, the tallow off it, for years later.
Absolutely.
Yep.
It gets better with time.
It peaks at about 1 year.
I'd say
Dan, Danny doesn't like people, you know, people age meat. Well, we should talk about aging meat. That's we have to back up in time because we're on to F and we need to go back to A, but we should really talk about aging meat. But Danny, when you kill a moose, talk about your theory on moose. Like when you kill it, when you eat it.
Oh yeah, I it's like seasoning firewood, man. I put it in the freezer and forget about it for, you know, till next fall. I mean, if I can, because it's pretty tough when it goes into the freezer. Hunting season in Alaska is in August, September for moose.
That's the funny thing about Alaska is like, you guys are doing all your stuff in August and September.
It's basically summertime, and then hunting season ends when fall comes.
And like when people down in lower 48 are getting all fired up for like November gun deer, it's like full on balls out winter. It's like nothing going on.
We're getting out the ice fishing gear and the skis, man.
So you get home from moose hunting, and you've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of meat, but it's, you know, in town, it might be 60 degrees in the daytime, so you can't hang it.
Flies everywhere.
So, you know, you're just in it's a race to get the thing in the freezer. You can't age it. You can't, you know, hang it at all.
When I think of Anchorage, I think of pick and blowfly larvae off stuff.
Yeah.
It's bad.
And so, you know, depending on the moose, man, like sometimes if you just were to cut a steak off a hindquarter that you just brought home from the mountains, I mean, it is so tough that it's almost inedible. But yeah,
metallic too, you know.
You know, I don't know what's the flavor. I just know I can't chew the damn thing.
You know that irony, like that gets tempered in time, I feel.
Yeah, I'm not sensitive to that, but
so Steve, I've told you about this, but 2 years ago Matt Carlson and I did an experiment. We shot those moose, couple moose, and it was the same thing as Dan was describing. Time crunch, hot out. Had to just process right away. So of the two moose, we put 7 quarters, backstraps, everything in the freezer. Then we kept 1 quarter, and we aged it. Matt kept on it for a week and butchered it, labeled it completely separately. I will say that aged meat for the first 2-3 months, it was better. But after 3 months of the stuff that didn't age, I prefer that for the next year.
Is that right?
The stuff that was aged, once you got out a year after it had been frozen, it was actually, it had a little bit stronger taste and it was drier.
Yep.
But immediately, the first couple months, it was definitely better.
There's so much. We are now talking about aging. I'm going to get back to freezing, but I'm going to tell two aging anecdotes to say that I don't know the answer to this. Years ago when I was in graduate school, my roommate shot a calf elk with his rifle. So it's already a calf elk, right? It was like late season, like February, so it's kind of beyond calf elkiness. Shot a calf elk with his rifle, and we hung that thing in my garage, and the weather in Missoula is just perfect where we never froze any of that thing. We hung in the garage. It was like 20 degrees at night, up into the low 30s during the daytime. And we hung it, and it got to be where, I'm not kidding you, you could shove your thumb into that elk.
Yeah.
Best thing I ever had. It was so good. We ate the whole
thing. Hide on or off? Off?
Skinned off.
Okay.
It'd get a rind on it. You'd cut that rind away. We'd cut a leg off, get some meat off the leg, lay the leg laying on a tool cabinet or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, and it just got better and better and better. Now, I always butcher my own stuff, but a couple years ago, we did an elk hunt in Kentucky. And due to heat issues and other travel considerations, I had did something that I haven't done in forever. Brought the meat, brought the whole elk, bull elk, not an old bull. How old do you think that bull was, Yanni? Yeah. Brought him down to a guy, and he hung the elk for 10 days in controlled circumstances. And I felt like that elk hanging 10 days wasn't, it still needed to go in the freezer for a long time. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I don't think you're hurting anything by aging it, but there's just like, I think it's so variable by the animal, by all kinds of climatic conditions, probably. I don't really know, but I know this. You cannot pull a piece of meat out of your freezer that's been in a year and tell me it's tough. It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, we went to, when Eric Kern, a friend of ours from back home, we like had kept in touch with because he lives in Montana, he got married. And he was married to a gal whose neighbor was out of town the weekend they got married. And the guy, out of the goodness of his heart, says, well, why don't you allow some wedding guests to stay in my home? Because I'm out of town anyways. So they let the groomsmen, of which I was included and my brother Matt was included, stay in this house. So we're staying in a man's home who's lent his home to strangers. Matt looks in the man's freezer and is horrified to find that this guy has a bull elk from 5 or 7 years. It was ridiculous. In the bottom of his freezer. Like, it just has that look like no one's ever going to eat this elk.
Obviously not.
So Matt thought it's wrong to steal. But it's not as wrong.
I love that you and Matt looked in some dude's freezer, by the way. That's awesome.
He's like, it's wrong to steal, but it's not as wrong as letting this bull elk rot or get inevitably tossed out when this guy drops some box and knocks the cord out of his freezer and it shuts down or he just throws it out. He's not going to eat it. If he's going to eat it, would he eat it? And Matt took it, and that elk was fine. Not, it was definitely like you could, it was edible. It was,
I bet,
edible.
The outsides were dry.
Yeah, it was. Well, you had to trim.
Yeah.
It was edible. It wasn't fine. It was edible. It wasn't going to get eaten. And I think about that. I don't want to say I think about that every day, but that was a bold move because Matt doesn't do things lightly. Like, he really weighs. He's not impulsive. He's not morally impulsive. It was an affront to him. This same guy, Matt, once killed a bull elk that was just the most horrifically tough animal I've ever been involved in. And he gave up eating anything for a while but boiled cabbage. Because he didn't want to waste any of his jaw power on anything but chewing up his elk. So at night, he would eat boiled cabbage and his elk. And I'm telling you, if he had froze that thing for 2 years, if he'd just been like, okay, that never happened, and froze it for a year, that thing would have been fine.
Would have helped.
I can't give any hard and fast USDA stats or anything, but I just feel that this is true.
I don't think anyone at this table disagrees.
Oh, in regard to tenderness?
Freezing meat makes it taste better. Now, which brings us to, I used to hate vacuum sealed bags because they always pop, but I realized they pop because of handling. And in some circumstances, it's just impossible to transport them. But vac bags are not bad if you treat them so delicately. But if you're the kind of guy who likes to get in your freezer and start digging around, you're going to pop all your freezer bags. I pack them between layers of newsprint now because the same thing I'm talking about, saran wrap and wax paper for red meat, but that doesn't work for fish, I don't think. I like it on salmon. I don't like it on halibut, but I don't like it on freshwater fish, perch, bass, bluegills. I don't like that stuff. I like to use vac seal. But when you vac seal, you can't mess with that bag and bang it.
It also helps to wrap in saran wrap before you vacuum seal it.
Was that right?
Do that?
No.
I like to do that.
No one told me about this.
Works good for a couple reasons. First, it keeps the... Sometimes, you know, the liquids will get in when it's trying to seal.
Into the seal, absolutely.
Yep. So,
and corrupt the seal.
Yep, so it prevents that. I also think it provides some protection if there's any pin bones from accidentally popping the seal. And then if you do break a seal, you still got a layer of protection on the fish.
That's a good idea.
So it's an extra step, but...
You know, we... Can't remember what I was going to say. While I try to remember what I was going to say, do you remember one time we went back, we were fishing halibut at the shack and came back with all of our halibut packaged and stuffed into a rubberized dry bag?
Yeah, I've done that a few times, yeah.
And then emptied it out into the freezer, and a couple weeks went by, and there was the most horrendous smell coming from your gear room.
Oh, from the dry bag?
And we kept going in there and taking everything out of that room, and no one would ever look in the dry bag, and we eventually found a pack of halibut.
Oh, that's right.
In a dry bag. And so we disassembled this room multiple times until someone finally says, I'm going to look in all the bags.
I forgot.
Because we thought it was a dead rat or something. It was a pack of halibut, man. God, that smelled.
You know what's funny? That same room was really stunk up pretty bad by a bag of dog poop that I was walking my dog, and I picked up his poop and stuffed it in a little bag and had it in a backpack or a coat pocket or something hanging in that hot furnace room. And months went by, and oh, the same thing, except worse. Yeah.
That's one thing about urban dog ownership. Like I don't have the temperament for dog owning, but urban dog ownership is like seeing people out. Like, as a kid, you know, and your dogs just ran, you didn't, like, associate with their droppings.
No.
But it's so intimate in an urban environment when you got to take your dog out. Just, it's still, like, steaming in the morning air, man. You got to bag it up and walk around.
Turn that bag inside out.
Take the most biodegradable substance on the planet and put it inside
a bag.
An unbiodegradable substance and throw in the trash.
Yeah. I'm going to run through a couple things. Giblets, freezing giblets, I do. Back bag, or I'll take just a milk carton or something like that and freeze them. Put a layer in, cover it with water, freeze it. Then you kill a couple more birds, put the gizzards and hearts and livers on top of the ice, add another couple inches of water till they're covered, freeze it. And I do perch that way. Like if you're just dinking around, like catching a couple perch now and then, flay them, throw them in there, add to it, and then eventually you got like a big thing of frozen fillets in water. I think that for freezing, freshwater, like low-fat freshwater fish, bass, bluegills, perch, I still freeze them in water. You know? It's just because nothing happens to it. You freeze salmon in water and it goes to hell. It looks like hell, but you can freeze those like white flesh freshwater things. Thawing? How do you guys thaw? Countertop?
Warm water or the countertop.
Yeah.
We don't have a microwave.
You don't use a microwave in your house?
I don't like them.
Why not? Because they're going to make you sick?
No. It's just because they if you're trying to thaw something in the microwave, it gets all cooked on the outside and brown and gross, and it's still frozen in the middle.
Yeah. I'm not Joe Microwave.
It's disrespectful.
Yeah. We go days without using our microwave.
Yeah. No, but you throw, I mean, for thawing fish, especially if it's vacuum packed, just throw it in some lukewarm water and it's thawed in no time and real even and doesn't cook it. And
in culinary school, which I did not attend, they are like ice water bath to thaw.
Oh, really?
But I do lukewarm water. If it's a vac bag, I do lukewarm water to thaw it. When I'm doing saran freezer paper thawing, I just set it out. on the countertop. If you're really smart, if you know like you're in town, like it's Sunday, and you know you're in town all week doing work, you know you're cooking dinner every night, I'll try to go down to my freezer and like pull what I'm going to be eating then. Instead of doing that every day where you're pulling, like, what am I going to eat tonight? You pull it and it's not thawed in time. And you're like, oh, and you're cutting it up. You weren't planning on cutting it up, but now you're cutting it up because it's not, you know. When I grind meat, like when I kill an animal in the fall, and I don't really feel like getting into sausage making, and I don't feel like getting into all the business, I'll take all the boned out meat that I'm going to use to grind. I'll pack it in gallon size Ziplocs and just freeze those big gallon size Ziplocs. If I'm in a super hurry, I don't even trim it. It's fatty. It's whatever. Tallow in there. I just freeze it in those bags. There's hair in there. And then I'll periodically pull a gallon-sized bag out, weigh it, thaw out, so I got 10% fat, pork or beef tallow that I'm going to put in there, and then I'll grind that gallon-sized bag of meat. And when I grind it like that, I thaw it until it's still icy and then run it through my grinder.
Yeah.
Then, and everybody says you can't do this, but it's total bullshit that you can't do this. I will then, so I thaw it, grind it, pull off whatever I'm going to make that night, and then I will bag it in those. I always do my burger in those little poly bags, which are the best thing on the planet, man.
The ones you grind right into?
Yeah, you buy like 10,000 of them for a dollar or whatever.
You got a little tape applicator.
Yeah, I got a tape applicator. I will thaw the big block, grind it, poly bag it, back in the freezer. And you cannot tell me you can't do that.
Yeah.
I have done it with hundreds and hundreds of pounds of meat.
Yeah, same here.
And you can Pepsi challenge it up and down. There is, wherever that comes from is BS. You can't do that.
How about on a steak? You're talking about burger. What about a steak?
Yeah, because I'll sometimes, if I'm in a hurry, I'll come home and I'll throw a whole deer's leg in my freezer. Tag and the ball still hanging off it. The evidence of sex hanging off it. In a game bag in my freezer. I'll pull that leg out, thaw that whole leg, part it out, freeze my steaks, thaw them back out and eat them later. It is, there is no difference.
But when you thaw out your steaks,
it's still good.
Would you throw one of those back in the freezer?
I just can't imagine the situation where that would happen. Like I thawed something out and then someone's like, hey man, you want to come over for dinner? And I'm like, oh. No, I don't imagine doing that.
If I thaw a big chunk of meat and I cut some steaks off of it, or if I only want half of it or whatever, I'll throw it back in the freezer. I do it all the time. I don't have a problem with it.
I tend to agree. I feel bad doing it.
Because they always told you can't do it.
Yeah, kind of like you shouldn't thaw something in the microwave, which I really try not to. I'd rather thaw it in the fridge, but I will in the microwave.
Thawing in the microwave. You know what I wish was here is, I mentioned a couple times, Hank Shaw probably has, like, he probably has a lot of answers to stuff like this because he thinks like that. But thawing in the microwave, I feel it sheds tons of liquid that it doesn't shed otherwise. Like if I took duplicate pieces of meat and thawed them in the micro, there's going to be a bunch of bloody, watery garbage in the bottom of the, on the plate. It wouldn't be there if I thawed it in my fridge. It's somehow like coming off fast. Somehow like the way the crystals are coming apart. I don't know. It seems to shed water. It just is kind of nasty. And then like Dane says, it gets warm and like brown. And
I will thaw red meat in warm water too.
That's something that I disagree with completely.
I stand by it. I totally
get
unwrap it.
In a waterproof bag?
Get it naked. No. I'll unwrap it. But you can't get I'll take the freezer paper off. You can't get the cling wrap off until it's thawed. You know, now just take the cling wrap meat, just throw it in some lukewarm water.
I don't like that.
It thaws pretty quick. And when you pull it out, it's just kind of soggy, you know, and I take some newspaper.
Looks like someone has been drowned.
No, trust me, man. Trust me. Try this.
And the water's all red.
Water's all red. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
It just ain't right.
But that's that liquid that cooks out of it anyway. But you you got the soggy piece of meat that just thawed, and just take some newspaper and just roll it up in that newspaper and just put some weight on it.
Squeeze all that water out of it.
Yep, and all that, and that newspaper will soak up a bunch of water.
And then you're reading your meat because that newspaper's never going to come off.
And just take that piece of meat and just set it on the counter on a plate. And like in 10 minutes, it's pretty and it's red.
But how do you ever get the newspaper off it?
It just peels off. It doesn't.
It isn't. It's not like those little Play-Doh things you get where you're
silly
like,
putty.
Where you run it over a newspaper and it picks the ink.
It doesn't pick
up
the color. It doesn't pick up the ink. No. Try it sometime.
Yeah, I will. I'm not afraid of anything.
I've eaten meat that you've thawed that way and cooked, and it was delicious.
You never know.
I can't. There's no way I could do
it. I don't like the look.
Dry it off, set it on your counter, and it'll sit in the air, and in 10 minutes, it's all red and pretty, and you'd never know.
Dude, here's the thing. Like, this is going to sound a little weird. Like, when I used to do a lot of fur trapping for muskrats and stuff, like, you'd rig up drowner wires or stuff. You remember this, Dan, and you come, the trap's gone, you know, and the wire's going down in the water. So, I got one, you know, and sometimes you had these one-way slides, so you had to reach down in there and feeling around, groping around, you know, and you'd feel the hair, and I'd always have, like, these nightmares when I trapped that you'd reach down and there'd be, like, a human's hair down there. And I'm telling you, I don't, like, just, like, meat floating in water. I just can't stand it, man. But again, those guys in Hawaii that made the best jerky I ever had, they kill a deer, the first thing they start doing is filling up buckets with water, and they put a bunch of salt in it, and they just dump all that meat in for the night. I'm looking at it, I'm like, what in the world are you doing?
Ducks and geese, man, waterfowl, soak them in salt water, it makes them better.
Really?
Yep. Oh, but I couldn't imagine doing that to a moose roast or a whitetail roast.
No, man, these boys did though, and that stuff come out looking like pale. It looked like pulling out Wonder Bread out of a bucket, man. It still tastes good, but it just like it just kind of sicks me out.
What are you taking out of the meat when you do that?
I have no idea.
Blood for sure, but I don't know what else.
I just feel like you're degrading it. Like when you take you take a Black Angus, like, prime beef steak. They don't soak that stuff in water. They don't want whatever's in that meat. They don't want that leaching out into the water.
I just don't think it's irreparable. I just think it can be fixed, you know? Yeah. Oh, when I was down at the cabin last fall, I shot a little buck with Ron Layton in his boat, and he...
Not from the boat.
No. But we
had to go to jail.
we motored in his boat, and then we, you know, we brought the boat, the deer back to the cabin in the boat. But on the way back home, you know, we stopped and dropped the front gate, and he made me rinse that thing out for a long time.
That's why he says his deer meat's good. He says his deer meat's better than anybody else's, and he says it's because it pickles it.
Yeah. And
I don't know about that.
It's kind of just hunched over the front of that boat, just grabbing that little buck by the antlers and just up and down and up and down. And he just made me do it for probably 20 minutes. You know, I was getting pretty wore out. But, you know, took it back and hung it up and you know, it dried. It just looked absolutely beautiful.
Dude, he swears by it.
Yeah.
Swears by it.
It was really nice.
It's salt water, though.
It's salt water.
Salt water, yeah. Now, speaking of pickling, that was on pickling. This, we have one pickled thing. I brought... pickled sucker. That's buffalo, which is a native sucker. Most of suckers, not most, same. Carp, you know, are non-native. Like your classic golf course pond golden carp is a non-native. Then you have a ton of native suckers in the U.S., but there's a sucker that's as big as a carp called a buffalo. And all those rough fish and northern pike are good pickled, and when you pickle them, it dissolves the bones. And if you open that up and eat it, it is the best thing you'll ever eat. Yeah, man, hell yeah, open it up.
Where's that from?
We shot them with our bows last spring in Wisconsin, bow fishing for them. And they're big. I mean, a buffalo sucker's like this. That's probably an exaggeration. I mean, these are like big 5, 6, 8, 10 pound fish, you know. Were you there, Yanni, when we shot that?
That's a big chunk.
Wrap your lips around that.
It's more than wrap your lips around that big chunk. Here, Brad, you're going to have mine.
All right.
If you like pickled fish.
I do.
That's as good as any pickled fish.
And that fish has so much bone, you couldn't have approached it when we killed it. You can't get... I got in there, man. I remember, like, this isn't my line, but someone was talking about cleaning shad, and he said it was like trying to fix a watch, you know, like deal with all the bones in there, you know? But I'm telling you, man, you couldn't go near that stuff. I was like, I'm going to debone this buffalo sucker. You can't. There used to be a commercial market for buffalo sucker. You know, it's like one of the more popular sucker fish. That's pickled. The other things that I pickle bony fish because it dissolves the bones. Bones just go away magically. I pickle, there's like a dog and a cat making a bunch of racket if you're hearing weird noise. The dog looks like an Arctic fox. I thought it was an Arctic fox. It has mange. I pickle bony fish. I pickle any bird, gizzards, hearts, and livers. Generally not livers, but the gizzards and hearts. I boil them till they're tender, then add them to pickling juice. I'll sometimes eat all the pickles out of a jar. If it's like good pickles, I'll eat all the pickles out of the jar. Then I'll just fill that jar up with bird hearts and bird gizzards and chunks of deer heart and everything else, and then wait 2 weeks and then eat that out of there. I'm trying to think what else I pickle. Probably about it. Can you think of anything you like to pickle?
Brian and I both pickle trout.
Trout?
Yeah.
Like how?
Straight, oh, just like that.
Pike, like pike or like you did that buffalo.
You throw it in raw. Like that was in raw.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
freeze it first, but
tenderize it.
Kill the parasites.
It's straight vinegar first, and then
yep.
Yeah,
that's vinegar.
Day with salt, day with vinegar, yep. And then pickling.
Oh, okay. Brine. That's how I do it there. So yeah, wash it real good. Then you do vinegar. Then I retain some of the vinegar. And then I like make a regular brine and put some of that vinegar back in there.
So you don't do 100% vinegar for a day?
Yep.
And then the brine?
Yep.
You don't do 100% or like a salty
brine
for a day?
No, I do salt water.
For a day.
Like saturated.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like floating egg.
For 24 hours. Yep. Then I do all vinegar for 24 hours.
Yep.
Then I pour most of that vinegar off and probably wind up doing like one part vinegar to one or two parts water. I have it written down. And then a bunch of horseradish, garlic.
Cloves, allspice.
Sugar.
Yep, sugar.
I like to make it sweet, man.
Yep, me too. Do you have lemon in there?
Never put lemon in there.
It's not bad. A friend of mine turned me on to that recently.
We don't really have access to white-fleshed fish here. I mean, like, you know, locally.
Burbot, don't you?
Well, our fishery got shut. The place where we like to fish burbot got shut down.
It used to be pretty good, but yeah. You can't fish until the ice goes out now. So,
really? Why? Are these getting overfished?
Potential for it.
They were clearly vulnerable.
Yeah, we were pounding them on there. You know how burbot or eopatas, a lot of people know them. They
also call them lawyers because like the assholes, the heart's right by the asshole on them. So people call them lawyer fish.
Lawyers,
you know that?
Yeah,
that's a good fish. They also call them poor man's lobster.
Oh, they're so good. Like, I grew up in Minnesota catching walleyes, we call them eel pout, throwing them on the ice.
I've never heard eel pout.
I can't tell you how many eel pout I killed without putting a knife to. Threw them on the ice. I moved to Alaska. Like, there's no walleyes here. What do you guys ice fish for? Burbot? Oh, eel pout. All right, let's try it. That stuff is legit.
It's amazing.
It's super good.
When I lived in Montana, we'd go out to this canyon ferry lake and fish perch. Then once it got dark, you had about an hour where you could get lingcod. We called them lingcod then.
Yeah, lingcod.
Oh, my God, it's a good fish.
They got a lot of names.
We'd boil them and dip them in butter like lobster.
Yeah.
Awesome that way.
How much time we got?
We're done. We're at an hour. This stuff is legit. Can you tell us how you make this?
Yeah.
Smoked salmon candy. How'd you get it so hard?
Just brine the shit out of it and then smoked it for a really long time.
How'd you catch this fish?
That's some sockeye salmon that Brant and I dip netted last summer.
Explain the dip net fishery. This will blow people's mind. In the lower 48,
you can't
this will
understand
blow their
it
mind.
If you don't see it.
But explain the dip net fishery.
So, yeah, first let me note that it's open only to Alaska residents, but there's a few rivers around where you can go. Take basically an oversized landing net that you can have. The hoop can be up to 5 feet in diameter, so they're absolutely massive.
And the handles are usually about 10, 15 feet long.
Yeah, yeah. So picture just a giant oversized landing net. But then instead of like that poly braided cord bag, it's got a bag made out of gill net. And so most of the fish you catch are inside the net, but some of them are actually outside the net. They just get tangled in the the gill net, but you're just standing out in the river and waders and nipple deep water, you know, holding
as
holding.
Far as you can go without getting
or in your boat too, right?
Yeah, or from a boat. Yeah, people use dry suits to get a little extra edge out there, or waders, or from a boat, whatever. But yeah, you're just holding this net in the water, and if you're in a boat, you're sort of motoring downstream. If you're waiting, you're just standing in the water. Some people put on a wetsuit and a life jacket, just float down the river with the thing, and you just hold it in the water, and you're fish banging into it, and you'll get one, two, sometimes three at a pop. But the limit is in the local fisheries is 25 for the head of the household, and then 10 more fish for each person in the household. That's an annual limit, so you can bring home.
So you'll,
of fish.
But you'll go and pull that. You'll go home and come home with 45 salmon.
Oh, we've come home with over 100. Yeah, depending on how many guys you go with and what their how big their families are, you know. But yeah.
Yeah, we had one day this summer we went and we hit it perfect. We weren't even gone for, I don't think, 18 hours from Anchorage. We came home with 100 fish.
100 salmon.
100 salmon.
How big
sockeye
are these salmon?
Sockeye salmon. Chrome red sockeye salmon.
Yeah, right out, just, yeah, we're 100 yards from the ocean. So they're super bright.
And how big are these a piece?
Not big. These are.
They're smaller. 3-5 pounds.
Yeah.
That's still a lot of fish, man.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They're gorgeous. That's what we're eating there.
It's equivalent to when you get a moose down and you think something's done, you got to chop it up. I mean, you go out, you have fun for 12 hours, now you got to fillet 100 salmon.
Yeah.
But that's it for the year. You're good.
So these,
yeah, how do you then go out and fish salmon? With a rod and reel.
Well, it's nice to get some variety, you know. Like a really, I mean, it's really nice to have some king salmon because they taste so different than everything else. But
man, anyways, explain how you made this. This is great, man. What part of the fish is this?
That's just a whole fillet. So these are kind of small sockeye that we were getting. That's a belly. That's pretty primo right there. But so they're kind of thin fillets, and I was just cutting the fillets into thin strips and leaving the skin on. And then I brined them with a dry brine that was 6 parts brown sugar to 1 part kosher salt. And that's it. That's the brine. But you can even
Did
go
you weight them? Put weight on them?
No. But I use a lot of it. So I got a big tub and I'll lay a layer of these strips in there and then just cover them in that brine. I mean, it's just pounds of brine. And then another layer of those strips, and then just cover it in not the brine, but the rub, you know, dry rub, whatever you want to call it. And you're just burying them in that stuff, and it pulls out so much moisture. You know, in a few hours, they're in soup. You started out with just dry brown sugar and dry salt, and in a few hours, they're just in soup because it's pulling so much moisture out of the fish. And the nice thing about having that ratio so strongly skewed toward brown sugar is that you can't over salt them that way.
I got you.
A lot of people will use.
So you can bombard them with brine.
Brine the hell out of them, and it's not going to get too. It's never going to get too salty. And I think you could probably even go 8-1 in that. You know, salt or sugar cures them just like salt does, right? So, if you get the ratio right, you can just absolutely brine the hell out of it and not worry about getting too salty.
So it turns to a brick.
Yeah.
Did you know that you probably noticed, freshwater fish piss much, much more than saltwater fish?
Yeah, yeah.
Like a freshwater fish absorbs water and pisses copious amounts, and a saltwater fish is always losing through osmosis. Losing water to salt. He's always losing his water and doesn't piss. Pisses a very small amount.
Yeah, in
water wants to flow to the direction to equilibrate with the salt.
That means the fish is shedding his fresh water. Saltwater fish is shedding all kinds of water to the ocean.
A fish in fresh water is holding on to its salt. And a fish in salt water is...
But water drains into his body.
Yeah, through the gills, yeah.
Yep. No, yeah. through pores in his skin.
Well, the surface area is in the gills. I mean, that's where the real surface area is, and that's where the gas exchange occurs, and that's where you get a lot. Just a lot of opportunity for ions to move across the gills.
Last thing I want to talk about. We got out of alphabetical order a teeny bit. What do you guys like sausaging. I'll tell you what I make for sausages. I make summer sausage, then I make a variety of fresh sausages. I do my fresh sausages, same blend, 90% lean, 10% fat. I do a handful of fresh sausages. I do them all in hog gut. And I freeze them all raw in back bags, 3 or 4 per pack. And that's all I do now. I used to do all kinds of, you know, I just do fresh. I don't do any like smoke, this and that. I just got away from it all. In summer or dawn.
Yeah, that's the only thing I smoke. Yeah.
Do we keep referring to donkey dick? Is that clear what we're talking about?
Summer sausage.
All right.
But Brant's on. We're running out of time. Brant's on to this new cheese that.
High temp cheese. It's revolutionized my
Brant's
sausage
on
making.
A cheese that you can put into a 500 degree oven and it won't melt.
It's awesome.
Is that natural?
For summer sausage. Here's what I'll tell you. I don't know. I won't use nitrate, so in the same summer sausage that I won't put nitrates in, I'll put high temp cheese in, so there may be some issues there. But
what
I will
what's
say,
nice is it's smoked and the cheese still has its integrity.
Absolutely. For brats squares. And for summer sausage, it's legit. It's good.
The best sausage making book out there is again Ruhlmann's Charcuterie. I think. Do you guys use that book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He don't talk about that cheese, though.
Try that right now. When I first told you about this, you were questionable.
Yeah, but you sent me some.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
You didn't even tell me.
No, I loved it. I didn't tell you I liked it?
I don't even think you told me.
Oh,
yeah,
that was rude of me.
Thank you. A little smoky, too. You can smell that smoke.
That's good.
A lot of mustard seed in there.
Yeah, what do you guys think about the ratio of mustard seed?
I like a whole shitload
of it.
Yeah,
I do too.
I think it
should be crunchy.
Yeah.
So you can get that high temp cheese in numerous flavors, and I like it. I think it's good. I've heard people question it. Maybe it's questionably impure, but I like it.
Dude, I never told you I liked the stuff you sent me.
Oh, man.
That's pretty rude.
I don't like.
Do you sit around at night being like, I hate Steve? All right. I know you people don't have a long attention span. We've already stretched its limits. Any concluding thoughts? Giannis, this is the least you've ever spoke in your entire.
It's been a long day. We got up about 3 a.m. to get here.
Dan?
No, I was going to go away with, like...
Concluding thoughts.
Yeah, I do. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you then.
I don't can yet, but one of the biggest draws for me is because I'm always up against, like, the freezer conundrum of, like, bam, it's Monday night, Tuesday night, and don't have stuff thawed out. And I would try to do the Sunday thing where I really plan ahead for the week, but... be so nice to just have that stuff, and it doesn't take up freezer space when your pantry is just stocked full of nice canned meat.
Yep.
And I don't even can my stock, so my stock is in my freezer. And
okay, yeah, canned stock is totally the way to go.
What if you had to recommend real quick? Give me the spiel on where I should go to, or like what piece of equipment I need to.
In my mind, there's only one. It's that big Presto. It's like the kind everybody has, the giant Presto.
Everybody in Alaska uses the
All American.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It does. It has a metal on metal seal. It has like a milled.
There's no gasket in there?
There's no gasket.
Well, you put Vaseline on there.
Yeah.
You don't need to.
But it doesn't have a gasket, so it just never goes bad.
I got you.
They're excellent, but they're a little spendy. All American's a manufacturer, yeah.
Mine's a big, I don't know, it must think it was made out of aluminum. One of those Presto ones, like Mom had.
I
have the same one Mom had.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't destroy it, you know? And they're not that much money. The big ass ones are like 60, 70 bucks.
Yeah, the ones we're talking about are significantly more than that.
150 maybe?
Jars.
I bought mine a long time ago.
But I'm telling
a couple
you,
hundred? 300? Wow.
When you go, they're 300 bucks for an All-American?
Yeah, for the size we have. You can do 14 pint jars in a bag.
Oh, so it's big. Because I think mine is 8. So
you can layer jar. They're tall enough that you can do.
Oh, really?
You can do two layers of 7 pints.
Okay. The cost is when you go and buy jars at an actual store. It's like they say not to, and I'm not saying people should go do this, but you know, a lot of companies will sell pasta sauce and pickles and stuff in a jar. It might not be up to specs and up to grade, but if it's got that size lid, they say the glass isn't as good.
I use them all the time.
I never had one break. Yeah. I don't know. I've heard you're not supposed to do that. I never had one break. The other thing is you see people throw them out. You go into any kind of like Goodwill, Salvation Army. They're in there. They're in yard sales. But like if you're going to go jar a whole bunch of stuff and you go in and buy brand new glass, it kind of feels like a little bit like not – it just feels a little off, like the amount of money you're spending to do it again.
It's kind of like jumping into Reload and buying a bunch of new brass at $1 a piece. It's expensive.
It's like reloading ammo. You got to reload years to make up for the startup cost. But I've bought very few jars in my life. When I see them, I just grab them. You know what I mean? And I keep them hanging out somewhere. And it's fun. It's fun to can, man. I like it. And then when everything goes shit, you know, and the world collapses and everybody's cannibalizing each other and there's no law and it's just total anarchy, your freezer's not going to be. Your freezer's not staying frozen.
You can start canning humans.
I know. We can all can each other. So that's another selling point. Unless you got a solar powered freezer. Yeah, canning's fun. It's old-timey. I like it.
Oh, there's something really satisfying about having just a whole cabinet full of pretty glass jars of stuff that you can. It's real nice.
I jar, too. I like to grow beets and make pickled beets.
I do, too.
And I jar. That's the only thing out of my garden that I jar, though. I'll jar tomatoes and I'll jar beets.
Pickle some green beans, too.
Oh, yeah. It's all right.
What a great gift, too, man. You want to, like, really...
My brother Matt, for Christmas, he sends out stuff like that. What are you going to do? Go give everybody a gift card? You know? Give them a jar or something, man. They like it. It's pretty.
Oh, man. That just shows love and respect and hugs and kisses all in, you know, one little package. There you go.
Brant, concluding thoughts?
I don't know, man. Processing meats, it's fun. And if you're going to kill animals, like, it's one of those things. You need somebody to get you into hunting normally. You don't get into it on your own. Same with processing your own meat. Generally, it's not one of those things you get into.
Yeah.
But once you do, it's worth it. And it's cost effective and it's rewarding. And recommend anybody who's interested in it to get into it.
Yeah, and team up with friends. Like, if you kill a deer, have a couple guys over and process the whole thing and give them like a third of it. I mean, it's not going to screw you. I mean, they'll turn right around and do the same for you. You learn a lot of stuff that way. All right, signing out. Thanks for listening.